All right, well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to our June call. I know there are 9 new chapters that joined since last month's call, so if you're one of those new chapters, really great to have you aboard. Thank you so much for being part of this effort to get us restored to a healthy climate as fast as possible. There are, right now, 985 people registered for our conference next week in Washington, D.C. That's the most people we've ever had registered for a conference. Right now, we have 477 of 535 appointments booked, so we're getting very close to being able to see the whole Senate and House. A remarkable amount of work has been done by many of you to be prepared for that, updating bios, inserting meeting notes, just doing everything we can to be as ready as possible, to have as much impact as possible when we start arriving there a week from today. So thanks, everybody, for the work for that, and it's just really remarkable work that's gone so far. If you're new to the call, we have a pretty standard format here. What we have is our guest speaker, who we're really excited about, that I'll introduce in just a minute, because we feel like every month we want to feel like we have a broader understanding of everything about dealing with global warming. But then we also have exercises so that we practice speaking about dealing with climate change effectively. We want to feel like not only are we more knowledgeable, but we're more articulate every month. We get a report of what's happened since last month. We want to make sure that there's a lot of actioning happening, so we measure a lot of things. We get into action with respect to the next month. And then I'll give you a quick update on the conference. And then also, yesterday there was a vote in the House on the Scalise Amendment, which was an amendment in opposition to poorly designed carbon taxes. So we'll talk about that and what impact we think it does or does not have. So a very, very chock-full agenda. Let me just say about our guest. The Yale Program on Climate Change Communication is one of our most important allies. We work really closely with this organization. We've had them provide keynote speakers for our conferences. We've had them on this call on a regular basis. We embed their information in the bios that you'll be getting in advance of the conference this coming Thursday. If you're coming to the conference, you're going to get a bio for the people you're meeting with, and their information is embedded in there. So I'd be hard-pressed to find an organization that we work with more closely. And, in fact, Betsy Schwartz has been a guest on CCL University. What we had planned all along is we wanted to have someone from Yale on the call just before the conference so that what Americans' views on dealing with climate change are very present. That's not just for those of you who are going to be able to come to D.C. this year, but for all of us. So we've got the most recent, most relevant information, and we're really, really glad that Betsy Schwartz could make herself available today. She is communication strategist, managing media and outreach analysis. She comes from Yale with extensive experience on designing, running, and winning national and local grassroots campaigns. So in addition to being an expert in an area we're interested in, she's also expert in an area that we're also very committed to being good in, which is the grassroots side of things. So welcome, Betsy, and could you start just by telling us a little bit about where Americans are? What do we know about that? Are things changing? Are they changing in the right direction? Are they changing in the wrong direction? Do we know anything about where Americans are with respect to what we're trying to do, putting a straightforward fee on fossil-based fuels emissions and giving that back to households? So welcome, and so great to have you here today.
Great. It's really wonderful to join everyone today. It was very exciting to hear where everyone is all over the country and even in some other countries. I'm very excited to talk to you guys today about all of those things, because we're in a pretty special moment around the climate movement. We just released our most recent survey, and the number of people who think the planet is warming is just about at the highest it's ever been in the U.S. And we're seeing critical rises in public opinion, beliefs, concerns, support for policy, across lots and lots of issues. And this is the kind of movement and ground that we need, that's needed in order to pass new legislation, in order to help talk to people about this in all of the communities you're in, all across North America and across the world, get more solar and wind in all these places, and help to adapt our cities and communities to the threats that are coming. So, as has been alluded to, we focus at YPCCC on what the American public thinks and believes around climate change. And this, these are the people who the decision makers you're about to talk to represent. So specifically, we study what people understand and misunderstand about climate change, the what policies they support or oppose, and I'll talk a little bit about tax and dividend and where we're at on that now. What messages move different people, and then how Americans act at home, on the road, at their workplace, in the voting booth, and when they go to talk to their decision makers. But in the end, we are scientists. So what we want to understand is why. So why is it that one group of people is highly concerned about this challenge? They want our government to do something about it, and they're willing to take action themselves, like joining CCL and maybe even going to DC. Why is it that another group of people are completely apathetic about this and don't pay very much attention to the threat? And why is a third set of people, why is a third person vehemently opposed to the kind of progress that you all are working on? So I'm going to talk about some numbers, and stop me if you want to insert some questions here, if you don't mind my just rolling on. But I'm going to present a couple of numbers. But what I ask you guys to do is think not just about this why question, but really as organizers, you want to ask, so what? So what do these numbers that I'm going to tell you actually mean for the communities you're trying to organize around you? And what do they mean for the movements that you're building and that you're talking to your decision makers about? So as was mentioned, I'm a organizer at heart and really by training. And I know that these numbers are become meaningful when we think about what they mean for how we mobilize and build a movement around them. So I want to talk a little bit about this was my plan, and stop me if this is not what you're interested in, but a little bit about where we are right now on public opinion around climate change, around a couple of key issues and policies. The moment that we're in right now, put it a little bit in context of the recent past. And then where we can go from here nationally and looking at state levels and even more local. So I'm going to just keep rolling on, but stop me if you have a specific question. Because I remember the last time that this many people, in the U.S. at least, thought that the planet was warming and were concerned about it. I was an organizer in Florida, all over the state, but really in focusing a lot of my time working with students in southern Florida. These are students who thought that they might have to leave their home where their family had been for generations because of the threat, because of sea level rise and extreme weather that they had been seeing. And we thought, when I was organizing, these young people there, 07, 08, back at the height, we thought that things were going to change. We felt people who were motivated about this around us, and things seemed to be moving. And then I moved to Ohio, and I was working on the federal legislation. The last time we had federal legislation that passed the House. And it was an incredibly exciting time, but not soon after that, the number of Americans who think that the planet is warming, who think that humans are causing it, who think we need to do something about it, plummeted. So in early 2010, and this is right around the time that that piece of legislation is moving to the Senate, only 57% of people thought humans were warming the planet. I was in D.C. by that time trying to help mobilize people in communities all around the country around this bill. And you could just feel a difference this lower level of concern. And at YCCCC, we've spent a lot of time trying to understand why this big dip, this understanding of this scientific phenomena, why is it so in flux within the American mind? So think back, I mean, just yourselves about what was going on in 2010 or between 08 and 2010. So the economy took a big hit. ClimateGate, big scandal about climate science happened. The Tea Party gained a lot of momentum in the U.S. Of lots of factors that were happening socially, economically, politically, there's really only one that we have identified as driving this. There may be more, but what we've seen is that it's actually the partisanship of the issue. It's the culture wars around climate change. As we know from studying behavioral science, humans are social. We develop our beliefs, our understandings, based on the various communities, tribes, identities, the people around us who we associate with. And this is why it's so critical that CCL is working in all communities across the country and in lots of other places. It's so important that we reach out to people all over, because this split is incredibly problematic for the kind of progress that you all are working on. But in the couple of the long, hard 6 years since that time, we have seen public opinion steadily rise back up. So from that low point in our numbers, 57% in 2010, we've been climbing quite a bit. We have seen first those numbers go up, belief in climate change, thinking that it's human caused, concern about it, first within Democrats a couple of years ago, then amongst independents, and then most recently in the last 2 years, there's been a huge surge amongst Republican Americans believing that climate change is happening. So at YCCC, we boil down the conversation around climate change, public opinion's belief of it in it, to 10 words. Is it happening? Is it us? Are humans causing this? Is it bad? Is it going to affect me? Is it going to affect things I care about? Is it going to affect other people? Is this thing bad? Do scientists agree? How do we know? And is there hope? Can and will we do something about this? And we are seeing beyond just is it the planet warming, we are seeing those other factors steadily rise too. They're not all quite coming back up to the moment that we had at the height back when I was organizing in Florida. But we're starting to see everything moving in the right direction. And it's an exciting moment, and a lot of this is because of movements that are building. It's because of the work that people like CCL are doing to mobilize people. And in many ways, if you dig below the numbers, you dig a little bit below just these 10 words, you can actually see that the moment that we're in right now, this increase now, is actually in many ways stronger and healthier than the moment we had in 07, when that 07, 08, 09, when that the legislation got through and then failed. And we know this because, just digging in a little bit as scientists, because of a couple of things I want to point out. So first, it's how Americans prioritize this issue. So we just released some numbers that asked, what are the top issues that you care about going into the election this November? Global warming is raising significantly. And just within liberal Democrats, global warming is now sixth amongst issues that they care about most. Clean energy is also within the top 10, and so is protecting the environment. Amongst Democrats in general, it's also very high. It's about in the middle across, average across the party. For Republicans, it's still fairly low in the issues that they want to prioritize, and that's something that we should be looking at. But Republicans don't all think alike when it comes to climate change, and this is critical to remember. So according to the new numbers, we have found that there's been a 10 percentage point increase in the last 2 years amongst liberal moderate Republicans. And there's actually been a pretty big rise on conservative Republicans, about 20 points. So it's all going back up. But they're not a monolithic group of people. And there's a pretty big divide. And when we think about who we talk to about climate change in those communities, it is a lot of people across the aisle who actually share a lot of the same values and priorities. And we want to make sure that this movement is inclusive. Now, looking specifically at a tax and dividend, our latest poll shows that a large majority of people, registered voters in the U.S., support a fee on carbon and giving that back to households. About 68% of people in the U.S. support that. So this is a big moment. This moment is stronger than we've seen before. And there's huge implications for this, for I think the conversations that you all are going to have. I think I'd be remiss to talk about one major issue that I think will be on the minds of many of the congressional offices that you're talking about, talking to, many of the Senate offices as well. That's the election. So I just want to make sure you guys have a few numbers around this, because they're actually pretty positive. Americans are more likely to vote for a presidential candidate who strongly supports taking action to reduce global warming. About 43% say they would be more likely to vote for a presidential candidate who wants to take action. And conversely, and this has been rising over the last couple of years, and there's only 14% who say they'd be less likely to vote for someone who wants to take action. And then conversely, Americans are less likely to vote for a presidential candidate who opposes action on climate change. And then looking again at a tax and dividend, a majority of registered voters support this policy. But then looking a little bit farther down, a majority of voters who for each of the major presidential candidates support this as well. Even Trump voters, about 51% of Trump voters support the policy as well. So I think there's some interesting things that are going to happen in the next couple of months that I'll be of very concern, I think, to some of the folks you're going to be talking about. But what's even more important is what happens after the election. No matter what happens in November, we're going to have a critical moment. We think these numbers in public opinion will continue to rise. When we're in November, we're either going to have a strong climate champion or a strong climate denier. And what's critical is that the movement that's being built out there harnesses these numbers, continues to grow these public opinion numbers, regardless of what happens in November, so we can move forward. So, again, looking at the movement, there's really one number of all of these that I like the most, that gives me the most hope. That number is 29 million. We estimate there are 29 million alarmed Americans, people who think climate change is definitely happening, are very concerned about it, and want to take action to do something about it, about 12% today. And these alarmed Americans are in every county, in every county, 3,000 plus across the country. So I know many of you are working in some of the toughest places in the country, and you might feel somewhat alone as you're organizing and mobilizing your community. But know that even in the counties, even in the communities that there are the highest number of deniers, we know that there are a bunch of alarmed Americans there. And that's in many ways the most critical places to be doing the kind of organizing you're doing. Okay, so I will stop in just a second. I hope this provided some perspective on where we are, where we've come, and where we are with around climate change. The American public is around climate change. And I think just take a moment, maybe before you go to D.C. or whether or not you're going to D.C., to reflect on the fact that we have almost the highest level of belief in climate change than we ever have before, and the other numbers are rising, and that this movement, both in what I'm seeing in the numbers and what I remember from being in Florida and then being in D.C., is in many ways stronger than ever. So take that with you as you, a couple of days from now, many of you are in D.C., and I would really, really love to hear how those conversations go, especially if you're using some of these public opinion numbers and some of the local public opinion numbers, which are all available online, as I'm sure CCL has helped you with. So I'd love to hear how it goes. My email is bessie.schwarz@yale.edu. Please let me know. I love to hear how those meetings go. So with that, I will stop there.
Bessie, let's try and get to a couple of questions. And let me just say that we're pretty enthusiastic emailers, so don't be surprised if a lot of people take you up on that.
Okay.
Oh, goodness gracious. Okay. I think that everybody on the call found that extraordinarily useful and encouraging. So, and the timing couldn't be more perfect. You know, we're always excited to get to D.C., but also there's a certain level of anxiety about, you know, we've got to get something done, we've got to get something done quickly. So I think this is a really, really useful piece of information. Let's see if we can get to just a couple of comments on some of the questions that were submitted. One question was did Pope Francis have a measurable effect on public opinion, and if so, do we know why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really wonderful question, and the short answer is yes. As we keep saying, this is an exciting time to go to D.C. and be working on this moon because public opinion is rising across a lot of beliefs. And we saw a particular bump last fall, and we think a lot of that may be able to be attributed to Pope Francis. So we polled people in the spring before the encyclical, soon after the encyclical came out, which folks remember is a big statement the Pope made around the moral impetus of action on climate change. And then we polled shortly after his visit to the U.S. We found in that third poll that 17% of Americans and 35% of Catholics say that his position on global warming strongly influenced their own on the issue. So more Americans think climate change is happening after we did that poll, and the number was higher amongst Catholics. More Catholics were worried about climate change, and more Catholics especially thought climate change was going to harm especially people in developing countries and more vulnerable. And even across parts of the encyclical's message, talking about it as a moral issue, a social fairness issue, or even a religious issue, Catholic Americans in particular rose in their understanding and their concerns about climate change on that level. So, the numbers show that particularly the Pope's visit to the U.S., talking to Americans, the media all the time, have the kind of influence on the way Americans think about this issue that really any politician or any public figure would die for.
You talked about the numbers going up with Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, and do you know what we attribute in particular the Republican numbers going up to? What is happening that more Republicans are saying, yes, we've got a problem and we need to do something about it?
Yeah, that's getting into the why is always very interesting when you're thinking about public opinion numbers. So as I was saying, the Americans used to be fairly united in terms of their belief around climate change, their concern, their desire to do so. So back in that height that I was talking about or around 08, the Republicans and conservative Republicans were fairly well aligned with Democrats. And then when we see that huge move down in 2010, we really see a big split. So everyone, all those groups, decrease in terms of their understanding of climate change is happening, but particularly Republicans. And again, it's always important, I think, to really to not just characterize Republicans, like any group, as just one voice, because conservative Republicans went down quite a bit. And then I think it's important to look at this, when you think about this, to look at the leaders of the party. You know, we used to have in the 2000s bipartisan legislation introduced. I know CCL is working hard on getting leadership across both aisles to focus on this. But, you know, we had strong leaders saying this is a problem. We had, you know, remember when McCain took a strong stance on this and then had to reverse it. So I think that we suspect is a strong reason why Republicans went down so much. And then particularly conservative Republicans were slow to come up quite a bit. You know, we can suspect there's also was quite a bit of money spent by conservative donors around climate change in particular that focused on a narrative shift around climate change and a big rise in a more conservative branch of the issue. And we think that air is starting to clear a little bit in general and around this issue in particular. And it's just so critical that we don't let this issue or try to extract it from the general culture wars that are happening in the U.S. and make sure that climate change, people are clear that climate change is affecting everyone. It is a major threat facing our future that we all have to focus on.
Yeah. Let me just go back to one stat you reported a minute ago, which was the 29 million Americans that are alarmed. So, you know, I've a lot of the time thought that I should be focused on the concerned, the next group just below that. But with 29 million alarmed, it seems like if you can get enough of those people focused, if we look at 29 million people alarmed, how would that contrast with what is our what estimates do we have for how many people are in the Tea Party? Because they've certainly been able to cause a lot of commotion, and I'm not sure how those numbers would compare. Do you know approximately how many Tea Partiers there are, and how many that how that contrasts with the number of alarmed Americans?
That's such a good question. And there's a lot to it. So at its height, I don't want to venture in numbers that I'm not so sure, but I know its height, the height of the Tea Party or number of people who identified in polls as Tea Partiers was around 2010. And that people who I believe it was just it was not more than a million, I thought, who were actually certified members coming to events, getting in the street, doing things around Tea Party. Don't quote me on that number, but I believe it was no more near 29 million. But to be clear, this 29 million are people. You can check out our website to have a fuller profile of what we mean by alarmed Americans. Those are not people who are all joining CCL tomorrow. These are people who we know think it's happening. They are very concerned about it. They definitely want to see action around it. Many of them say they'd be willing to take action themselves, even political action of some kind, convince an elected official to take a stance, for instance. But these are not, there are not 29 million people in the street doing something.
Right.
So, yeah, we should go back and compare those numbers to the people who share some of the same Tea Party values. And then I do think that we need to look at the number of people who are actually joining this movement now, the number of people who could join the movement, and compare that to what actual action we saw around the Tea Party movement.
Great. Well, boy, Bessie, that was a lot of information in a little time. That's extremely useful, and thank you so much. I mean, as I said at the start, you know, your organization is such an important organization for us. I think for all the people who are coming to D.C., it's probably somewhat comforting to know that your data is embedded in our, with respect to their specific congressional district, embedded in our bios. We do a pretty big debrief with you guys after the conference. So in addition, if you hear from some individual people, we'll be giving you an overall evaluation of what we see. You know, things really trended in the right direction for us in terms of more people supportive of policy, less pushback on science, more people, you know, double the number of Republicans saying they believe climate change is man-made. So everything went the right direction, and we'll be debriefing you after we get all the notes from Washington again. And if you want to stay around for the next 10 or 15 minutes, you're certainly welcome to, but thank you so much for that. That was extremely useful.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to talk to you, and I'm very excited to hear how those meetings go later this month.
Okay, and just remember, if you get a ton of emails, you ask for it.
I know.
Okay. All right, so I want to transition over to some of the things that happened since last month's call. I want to start in Canada because we had some big activities in Ottawa and Parliament Hill this week. I do want to mention also how exciting it is that we do hear some of the international groups signing in on the call live. I know most of them listen to the recording, but hearing Sweden signing on this morning with me was really, really exciting. So, Kathy, let's start with what happened on Parliament Hill this week.
Bonjour, Mark.
Bonjour.
Okay, so from June 5th to June 8th, 31 citizen climate lobbyists gathered in Ottawa. We represented five of the 10 provinces from coast to coast. There were 29 Canadians and 2 Americans. We lobbied 36 members of parliament face-to-face, as well as aides of 2 of the Conservative MPs that were not available. We also lobbied at the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change. A breakdown of the numbers are that we lobbied 9 Conservatives face-to-face, plus the aides of 2 pretty important, they're all important, Conservatives. 21 face-to-face Liberals were lobbied, 5 New Democrats, and 1 Green. We hosted our 4th reception on Parliament Hill and had the greatest attendance ever. We co-hosted it with my Member of Parliament, Paula Five, from Sudbury, and he highlighted it in the House of Commons on June the 7th, and that video has currently been viewed over 800 times. At the reception were 14 members of Parliament, and another nice, two more nice things about this reception is that the Speaker of the House was there, so that would be the equivalent of having Paul Ryan at one of your receptions, and for the first time at one of our receptions, we had Liberals and New Democrats in the same room. Lastly, I just want to say to everyone, the success of this event was the efforts of many. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, and Kathy, let me just echo that. For everybody who had something to do with that extraordinary work, and if you're not familiar with Canadian politics, that would be like us having a reception with equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats at it. So that's just great. Congratulations and having the speaker there. And, you know, as much effort as it took in that, I looked at the registration and saw still some people are coming from Canada to D.C. next week. Remarkable after doing that on Parliament Hill. Other exciting things happening internationally since last month's call. So the Germans had their second conference. So we've had two conferences in Germany. And we had our first meeting in Kampala, Uganda. And we'll make sure we circulate the pictures of that. Just seeing those people in Uganda having their first CCL meeting was really, really exciting. One of the actions we're going to ask you to focus on this month is your media campaign, your letters, your op-eds. And I want to see if I can offer a little bit of a fresh perspective on that. So it's really, really important, the job you've all been doing of making sure those get in front of your members of the House and Senate. Some of the people that are really Washington insiders told Danny this week that the reason that they put the Scalise Amendment up again, even though it had been voted on in previous years, is because your efforts are making people nervous, like naming not everybody, but specifically what CCL is doing to build support with conservative members of Congress, and that was the reason that the Scalise Amendment was put up to vote on again, even though it had been voted on before, was because you're getting people's attention and scaring them a bit. But I want to add one more perspective to those letters and op-eds and think about the influence that it has. So let's think about CCL differently for a minute. Let's think about it as if we were a traditional business. If we were a traditional business and we had a product and we had to sell that product, we would do marketing and advertising. So if instead of doing what we're doing, grassroots organizing, if we were a regular traditional business, and let's say the name of that business is Selling the World. So we had to sell a project called not selling the world, but saving the world. And if we took all of the op-eds and letters to the editor that you published, and if we had to purchase that space, instead of getting free space of getting our message out to millions of people, if we had to purchase that space, what would it cost us? So Steve Volk, our media director, did an analysis, and he didn't use the Atlanta Journal-Constitution where he is because that is one of the most highly circulated newspapers in the country. So what he did is he took the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, a relatively smaller paper, and said, how much would it cost to buy an ad that was the size of an op-ed? And it would cost $2,952. So if we bought advertising that was the equivalent of one of our op-eds in a small to medium-sized paper, that would cost us $2,952. If we multiply that by the 553 op-eds that you published last year, that would mean we got $1,632,456 free in paid advertising. Now, Steve said we need to take one other cut at this, in that people spend a lot more time reading the opinion page and articles than they do advertisements. So he says really you ought to double the value and say that that's about a $3 million value. So every time, in a certain sense, you could think that you get an op-ed published, it's like this free advertising that we get to the public. Same thing with letters to the editor. The average cost, if we had to buy the space for a letter to the editor, the average cost is $540. If you multiply that by last year's 3,064 letters to the editor, again, that would end up being $1,654,560. So Steve says, once again, you should double that. So if you think about this campaign of all of you regularly getting published with letters and op-eds, if we were a traditional organization, that's $6 million of free marketing, $6 million of free marketing and advertising. So if you're wondering, should I submit again this month, I hope that's another reason why, in addition to us getting it in members of Congress, clearly it's getting their attention. It's also like if we had to buy it, we would have to have raised an additional $6 million. So thank you for getting a huge amount of our message out, and in this case, getting it for free. Now, speaking of op-eds, I made a major, I don't know how I had it in my notes last month, but in April, Anchorage got three op-eds in 1 week. Three op-eds in 1 week. It was in my notes last month. I didn't mention it. So my apologies, Anchorage. I meant to mention that last month, and I just flat out missed it. Okay, quick update on the conference, then I'll go over the our take on the Scalise Amendment and then the actions for this month. So first of all, next Thursday you're going to be getting your schedules if you're coming. So if you're coming to D.C., you're going to be getting your schedules, bios for the people you're meeting with, and the meeting notes from previous meetings that we've had with that member. So on Thursday, please check your spam folder if that doesn't get to you, because we're sending this out to hundreds and hundreds of people. It might not come right into your inbox. Your email system might put it in your spam folder, so check your spam folder, and then print all of that out. That should give you some time between now and the following Tuesday when we go to Capitol Hill to set up times to talk to the people that you'll be meeting with. If you can't do that by phone in advance of the conference, there'll be plenty of time on breaks. And if you arrive on Saturday, we've reserved a couple of rooms so that people can get together and meet with their team so that you can talk about the strategy. In some cases, there will be a meeting plan that's already been written up by the group and a liaison, and that'll be part of your preparation. People will start arriving on Saturday. Sunday at 8:45, we will start live streaming the event. So both days, 15 minutes before the conference starts, we'll start live streaming. So that's something that we'll be getting information out about this week. We've never live streamed the conference. It's a way that people who don't actually come, either you can't come, it doesn't work for you to come, or just as a matter of principle that you refuse to use your carbon footprint like that, which I respect, you'll be able to experience by streaming. And then also a film crew from Years of Living Dangerously will be there, so you might run into them. So live streaming starts 8:45 on Sunday and Monday morning. So we'll be working, educating ourselves all day Sunday, on Monday with plenary sessions, just an important word for everybody's together, and 23 breakout sessions. If you haven't reviewed the number of speakers at the conference, there's 84 speakers, which is about four times as many people as we had at our first conference. Look through that. It's a pretty impressive group of people. So we'll be on Capitol Hill all day on Tuesday, and then Tuesday night we'll have a reception back at the hotel, and we'll be giving Representative Curbelo and Representative Deutsch as awards, thanking them for starting the Bipartisan Climate Solution Caucus. Also on Monday will be call-in day, which is what we're asking you to do as part of your actions this month, is to plan your how your group is going to get additional people to call in on Monday. And, you know, if everybody who's not coming, you could call, but then reach out to everybody you can think of and ask them to call. I remember 2 years ago when one of our groups went in on Tuesday after we had call-in day on Monday, and they said, yesterday our phones were swamped about you coming. And we asked them what swamped meant, and it meant 10 calls. So if we can get people to call, it makes a big impact on it. They get attention, and let's make sure that we make a full-on effort on that. Now, let me just say also we've been staying in very, very close touch with the leaders of the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. They have not given us a green light yet. So please do not plan in your meeting plans to ask people to join the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. We may update that if there's a change Sunday at the conference, but at this point, they want to continue to move at the pace they are. We're completely comfortable with that. When people ask us to do something, we do what they ask us to do. Okay, and then once we finish, we'll get all the meeting notes in. We'll send any follow-up materials, we'll debrief the minute notes, and we'll go back for our November lobby day to update Congress about where they are with respect to solving global warming. All right, so in terms of Canada, what we're going to be doing is continuing to comment on the Ministry of National Defense website for public input, and particularly asking people to make links between climate change and global security. And then also continuing to document who of your friends have signed our online parliamentary petition and urging other people to do so. So we're going to keep that effort up. In the U.S., we want you to make plans to participate in the June 20th call-in day. And as I said, strategize ways to generate more media. So, you know, in addition to getting it to Congress, if you see that was $6 million of free advertising for our effort, Let's just continue to expand that and make it $10 million this year by the amount of activity we generate. And then we're asking you to practice our communication skills. So the important thing is every month we practice. So we gave you two role plays, one for Republican office, one for Democratic office, and also a laser talk. So whichever or all of those you practice is important. It's just important that every single month we practice. The only way you improve is not by thinking about something. It's actually by practicing. Okay, then as I mentioned, there was a vote on Friday on the Scalise Amendment. The Scalise Amendment actually has really good criticisms. If you designed a carbon tax poorly, they're really good criticisms actually. And built into our education for Sunday night during the training for the conference next week, or excuse me, the week after next, don't make you get nervous, next Saturday as we're going to start arriving in D.C., is actually pointing out all the things where their observance are, where their comments are correct if you design something badly. You know, it could be bad for poor people, could be bad for the economy, could be bad for jobs. Our proposal is not, but if you design one badly, we're not going to go in and attack people if they sign the Scalise Amendment. We're going to simply show them that we share their concerns and how designed correctly all those issues are taken care of. So a couple of things that I thought you should know is last year there was 155 co-sponsors on the Scalise Amendment. This year there were 80. So it's getting a lot harder to get co-sponsors for it. And this year, in addition to making it much harder to get co-sponsors, there were 14 Republicans who did not vote on it at all, including Mia Love, who is a we think a potential rock star, and Jolly, who voted present. So it was much harder for them to get co-sponsors. You know, some people say to me, well, you know, if they sign the Scalise Amendment and they say they're against the carbon tax, won't that make it harder for them to vote later? I'm not worried about that. Most of those people had already voted for a Scalise non-binding amendment. So this is just part of the information we'll have as preparation, as the things that we're prepared to go in and talk to them about when we get to D.C. next week. So. Last thing about D.C., right now there are 985 people registered. That represents seven countries in addition to the U.S. We're not so sure that a lot of the people from Asia and Africa will make it because of visa problems, but nevertheless they're trying to. I think a lot of them won't pull it off, but I certainly appreciate the effort. We have 477 appointments scheduled right now and 85 people speaking. All right, everybody, great month this month. Let's get into action and make something big happen. When we're on the call in July, where our guest speaker will be from the Audubon, we'll also be able to give everybody a full report from what happened at the conference.